My name is Jared Kushner. I am senior advisor to President Donald J. Trump. When my father-in-law decided to run for president, I served his campaign the best I could because I believe in him and his ability to improve the lives of all Americans. And now, serving the president and the people of the United States has been the honor and privilege of a lifetime.
A rare public statement from Jared Kushner after his testimony today on Capitol Hill. Kushner told the Senate Intelligence Committee that he did not collude with Russia. He said he didn't know anyone on the campaign who did. And he said that all of his actions were proper in the course of a, quote, very unique campaign. Kushner testifies before the House committee tomorrow. Now, competing for time and political oxygen in all this, the Democrats and their leader in the Senate, Chuck Schumer.
Week after week, month after month, we're going to roll out specific pieces here that are quite different than the Democratic Party you heard in the past. We were too cautious. We were too namby-pamby. This is sharp, bold, and will appeal to both the old Obama coalition, let's say the young lady who's just getting out of college, and the Democratic voters who deserted us for Trump, the blue-collar worker.
Some may wonder.
Economics, George, is our strength.
Some may wonder.
We are going to go at it.
Schumer on ABC this weekend laying the groundwork for today's big rollout of the Democrats' new message and slogan. And here it is. This is it. A better deal. Better skills. Better jobs. Better wages. Ed O'Keefe reports for The Washington Post, and he's with us now. Hi.
Good to be with you.
Okay. What's been the reaction to this new sharp, bold slogan?
A little bit of meh and a little bit of really? And a little bit of, that sounds an awful lot like Papa John's. Better ingredients, better pizza. Look, top leaders here in Washington convinced that campaigning a little more like the Republicans do in headlines instead of fine print is the way to go, acknowledging that what President Trump did quite effectively last year is relentlessly message what it is he wanted to do and has tried, at least, and some would say failed so far this year, to deliver on those promises. Certainly Chuck Schumer would say that. And he acknowledged in an interview with me yesterday, last week, in Sunday morning appearances yesterday and then again today at this event in Virginia, that the party needs to work on this, needs to be much more relentless in telling people what they are for and not just what they are or who they are working against. You'll notice today and in the rollout that they presented early this morning, it's all about the economy. It's going back to James Carville's old line, it's the economy, stupid. There's no conversation in this about LGBT rights or bathroom bills or Russia and collusion or, you know, police issues, things that are very important, and by no means are we discounting them to large parts of the Democratic Party base, but that Democratic leaders believe are the key issues that can bring forth anyone, be they conservative, liberal, moderate, black, white, gay, or straight, back into the Democratic Party fold and help them elect Democrats to the House and maybe a few more to the Senate next year.
Yeah, it's really interesting because a poll, I think, put out by your organization and ABC found that only 37% of Americans think the Democratic Party stands for something. 52% say it just stands against Trump. And yet you see on television when the Democrats come on, Democratic leaders, they are just talking about Trump and Russia.
Right. And, you know, they'll blame us and say that, you know, it's because the media focuses too much on that. Not necessarily. You know, they you look at their Twitter feeds and whatnot, they're talking mostly about this. They're responding to the news or the announcements from the White House or from the ongoing investigations. This, at Schumer and Nancy Pelosi's bequest, is designed to get them refocused and say, look, you know, we're going to have all that. And the various committees and investigative bodies that are looking into that will do their work. We've got to go out in the meantime and talk about what we would do if we get back control of the House and maybe in a pipe dream get back control of the Senate. The reason is because the map for Democrats next year is much more difficult in the Senate. In the House, they've only got to pick up about 24 seats, which most independent observers believe is actually a reality or a possibility, given how unpopular the president is right now and how Republicans are failing to get anything enacted.
Well, Nancy Pelosi has called this a presentation correction, not a course correction. Is that accurate?
She can call it that, but frankly, having watched the rollout that they did earlier today, it was quite similar to most of the public events the congressional Democrats hold. There were 10 of them on stage. They all gave long speeches in the hot sun. Only two of the 10 who spoke are actually from Midwestern, non-coastal states that Democrats need to win in. And while they talk about wanting to campaign in headlines instead of fine print, those speeches very quickly got down into the dirty details and didn't seem very lofty and soundbite-driven. So we'll see whether or not this really is embraced by Democratic, not only lawmakers, but perhaps more critically, Democratic candidates across the country, whether it's in those swing districts near you in Southern California, or in suburban Chicago, or in Texas and Florida, Virginia, New York, the places where they think they can make some gains. And if they do that, they've got to do it in swing districts or Republican districts where they believe a more universal message focused on economic matters can help them win.
Right. So what does that do to resolve this split we keep hearing about and talking about within the party itself?
Well, I think that's part of why they've opted to just focus on economic issues and leave out all that other conversation, you know, talk about social issues or even, frankly, some more specific economic issues. You know, there's talk in this plan about a living wage, and while most lawmakers here in Washington have endorsed a $15 minimum wage, there are a lot of moderate Democrats out there who can't go that far, who say, yes, of course, wages should go up, but I can't commit to the $15 max at this point because my state couldn't afford it, or I just don't want to be telling businesses that they have to be spending that kind of money. Again, the belief is that this allows the party to focus in on some very specific, broad, and in some cases specific proposals, things like, for example, finding ways to cut the cost of prescription drugs. If you look at recent polling, Democrats and Republicans, majorities of them, say that's got to be tackled. Well, Democrats believe they've got a plan. Concerns about corporate mergers, for example, maybe the AT&T-Time Warner merger that's being worked on right now. Is that good for customers? Is it good for the worker? Democrats are proposing some more stringent guidelines that would require the Justice Department to take a stronger look at these things for potential antitrust violations, and then to keep tabs on those mergers a few years into them to make sure that they're still looking out for the little guy, as Democrats would put it. So those kinds of sort of modest proposals that in different ways can be targeted at different groups of voters but keep that economic theme. There's even something in there, frankly, for microbreweries. Perhaps that's designed to win over the hipster vote. I'm not sure.
All right. Thanks so much. Ed O'Keefe, reporter for The Washington Post.
Take care.
Okay, we want to hear from you. What do you think about the Democrats' new agenda? You can weigh in on Facebook or Twitter at KCRW Press Play. President Trump may not have accomplished much legislatively in the past 6 months, but he has had one major accomplishment, and that is remaking the federal judiciary. Trump has already nominated 27 lower court judges, in addition to putting Neil Gorsuch on the Supreme Court. If approved by the Senate, these young and conservative judges could influence the American judicial system long after Trump leaves office. Also, California's new and controversial recall election law has its first legal challenge. To discuss these stories, we're joined by Loyola Law School professor Jessica Levinson. She's here every Monday to break down all legal things and make them understandable. Hello.
Thanks for having me.
Great to have you, as usual. 27 lower court judges. That sounds like a lot.
It is, in the words of President Trump, huge. I mean, this is a lot. If President Trump keeps this pace, and if many of these nominees are actually confirmed, which it looks like they will be, then about one in eight cases in federal court will be heard by somebody that President Trump appointed. That is an enormous influence that one president can have over the judiciary. And that's important for so many reasons. And these are, as you said, these are young conservative jurists. And their average age, I think, is about 48. For President Obama, the average age of nominees was closer to 55. And these are people who have their seats for life. Hmm. And if you think about things that people care about, gun rights, abortion, anti-discrimination, climate change, immigration, 95% of the decisions that affect those issues are made by lower court judges. So everybody kind of has their eyes on the Supreme Court, and everybody talks about Justice Kennedy and will he retire. You know, the Supreme Court is incredibly important, but again, 95% of the decisions are not happening in the Supreme Court.
So you would argue that the lower courts are indeed more important in terms of day in, day out effects.
Well, I would say incredibly consequential,
yeah.
Yes.
Okay, so who is he nominating?
So he's nominating, in some cases, they are people who fit the mold of people who would get a nomination from any Republican president. But in a lot of cases, what we're seeing is people who are much more outspoken and much more to the right of mainstream conservative thought. So, for instance, we have a judicial nominee who blogged and called Justice Kennedy a prostitute. We have a nominee who blogged and said that Roe v. Wade, the decision that legalized abortion, was akin to Dred Scott, a decision that allowed for slavery, said that African Americans weren't citizens. And so there's two things I think to keep in mind. One is mainstream conservative judicial thought is to the right of what it used to be about 30 years ago. So the sands are shifting from under us, and the middle ground for conservatives is far to the right of what it used to be. And now President Trump, by nominating these individuals, again, very outspoken bloggers, people who I think aren't even seen as kind of in the core of this mainstream, will be once again shifting the entire seismic center to the right. And this is something that people, when we were talking about the 2016 election and we were talking about the effects, a lot of people tried to say, but look at the judiciary and look at the impact that a president can have. And if you
plus they need to be confirmed by the Senate. So the Senate is Republican, and so they're just going to rubber stamp anyone who comes before them?
Well, there may be some. I mean, we've seen with the health care debate that maybe the GOP won't all vote in lockstep on all issues. But we no longer have the filibuster for judicial nominees.
Right.
So all we need is for the Republicans to agree, and we need, 50 plus one to confirm these judicial nominees. Now, for me, what's really important to keep in mind is for the first 6 months of President Trump's presidency, we've said, OK, the judiciary will save us. When we talked about the travel ban, when we talked about immigration proposals, when we talked about maybe pulling out of the Paris Accord, and we said, well, judges will be the ones to say we are acting as a stop against presidential power. That may no longer be the case in a year.
All right. Let's turn now to California's new recall law and the lawsuit challenging it. Talk about that. This law the legislature passed last month changes California's recall election process. And this was done, it seems, to benefit one person in particular.
This is just so dispiriting. This is just such a terrible power grab. So
By
the Democrats. There is a state senator, Josh Newman. He is in a district in L.A. and Orange County, and I think it also encompasses part of San Bernardino.
In Fullerton.
And he has a razor-thin Democratic majority in his district. And he had a razor-thin win. And he voted in favor of the so-called gas tax. And there is a conservative radio host named Carl DeMaio. And he basically has targeted Josh Newman and said, we have to recall him. And those efforts were quite successful. And they actually gathered enough signatures that if they were verified, would put a recall election, again, these are rare elections, a special election on the ballot. Now, we need, or Democrats need, State Senator Josh Newman to keep their supermajority. And they don't want a recall election because recall elections tend to have voter turnout of approximately the number of people who work at KCRW.
And they're motivated, and they have a particular reason to come out and vote.
And they tend to be more conservative. So Democrats really decided that they wanted to push the election so that they could have this recall election, if it happens, in the June primary, when there will be more Democratic voters. So
basically to try to prevent this recall from happening.
Or at least to have the recall happen on an election time that's more beneficial.
Why is that bad?
Well, I think it's bad for a couple of reasons. One is you're changing the law for every other recall. So you're making a systemic change when what you're really trying to do is target one individual. I also think that, and I know everybody's just going to laugh me out of the room, but there should be some things that are not just based on partisan power grabs. So if we look at direct democracy in California, it you know, I can't even use this word on the radio to describe what a mess it is. And there's real problems. But a law that just says you have more time to gather signatures, or people who sign petitions can take their names off of the petition, or there needs to be a review by the Department of Finance, three things that this law says that talk about how costly recall elections are, that's not getting at all of the problems of direct democracy. That's getting at, let's try and keep Josh Newman in his seat.
Looks like they might be successful at that. Jessica Levinson, law professor at Loyola Law School. Thank you.
Thank you.
Coming up, USC received questions from the Los Angeles Times for more than a year about its hard-partying medical school dean, and yet the school apparently only just began to investigate. We'll talk about whether USC violated medical ethics next on Press Play.
Introducing the KCRW donation car, designed to be recycled. This first-of-its-kind vehicle will save you time, space, and hassle by disappearing. Enjoy the luxury and comfort of turning your underused car into a donation worth hundreds, even thousands of dollars. The KCRW donation car, already in your garage, driveway, or on cinder blocks outside your house. Act now at kcrw.com/cars.
This is Press Play. I'm Madeline Brand. A week ago, the LA Times dropped a bombshell about the former dean of USC's Keck School of Medicine. While he was dean, Dr. Carmen Pugliafito used illegal drugs, including meth. He consorted regularly with a prostitute. She had to be taken to the hospital after an overdose in a hotel room registered to Pugliafito while he was still dean. In the weeks since the Times investigation came out, USC has begun the process of firing Pugliafito, who remained on the faculty, and he kept seeing patients after he left his post as dean. Dr. Lydia Dugdale is a professor at the Yale School of Medicine and Associate Director of the Program for Biomedical Ethics there. Hi.
Hello. Great to be here.
Well, great to have you. And when you heard this story, what stood out to you about the allegations against Carmen Pugliafito?
It's definitely shocking to hear of this sort of behavior from a medical school dean. I was blown away.
So what about the ethics involved, right? The Hippocratic Oath?
Yeah, sure. So, the Hippocratic Oath is something that we commonly think of as saying, do no harm. You know, doctors are supposed to do right by their patients, and that's what patients expect. But the Hippocratic Oath, which doctors have been swearing for millennia, actually has this line that most of the time goes overlooked. And it's a line that says, I will keep pure and holy both my life and my art. And it's interesting because we don't quote that very often, but this idea that both a doctor's art, that is the art of practicing medicine, as well as his or her own life, should be kept pure and holy, or, you know, morally upright. There's a sense that the physician's responsibility goes beyond just medical practice, but to all of his or her life.
Mm. So basically being professional, both on the clock and off the clock, in a way.
Yeah, that's right.
So in general, though, what are the ethical expectations of doctors?
Yeah, sure. A couple of decades ago, in light of the changing healthcare system and sort of everything that's gone on in recent decades with healthcare, a number of professional organizations got together to try to think through this, and they crafted what they came to call the Physician Charter on Medical Professionalism. And more than 130 healthcare organizations ended up signing on to it. And this was an attempt to sort of update what the Hippocratic Oath is talking about. And the charter gets to things like morality, accountability, assured competence, promoting the benefit of patients, social justice, making sure patients are informed, working towards the good of society, and integrity. And this piece about integrity is interesting to me, because this integrity we think of often as being moral or having strong moral principles, but it's also a quality of being whole or undivided, and a sense of cohesion or coherence in one's life. And that, of course, would stretch across the professional life as well as the personal life or the private life.
And certainly there has been no evidence to prove that this is so, but are there worries when you hear this kind of story of a doctor who is perhaps not performing at his utmost when it comes to taking care of his patients or advising students in this case, or even interacting with other faculty members he might hold a mentorship role with while he is conducting himself in his private life, you know, in hotel rooms snorting meth?
That's right, yeah. I mean, certainly, I think all physicians would agree that their primary concern is the welfare of patients. And so any time that a physician's behavior could have an adverse impact on the care that he or she can render a patient, we need to, you know, our red flags need to be waving. I mean, we need to go on alert. So we always just take that so seriously as a profession. But beyond that, certainly anyone in a leadership role who is assuming the care and responsibility for others, whether it's teaching, accepting grant money and conducting studies, you know, around the world and using taxpayer money to do so, or fundraising for an institution, absolutely that person must be above the board. I think leadership demands moral accountability. And you know, the maxim that comes to mind here is too much has been given, much will be required. And I think that the more leadership, the higher the level of leadership that a person assumes, the more that individual should be accountable to those around him or her and underneath.
Well, what about the administrators at USC? What was their responsibility? Presumably, they learned about this or they heard about this at least a year ago, or possibly more, from the LA Times, if not from Pugliafito himself, who knows. But the LA Times had repeatedly asked the administration for comment, and they refused to comment. In fact, according to the paper, returned a letter unopened, a letter asking for comment. Did the institution, do you think, looking at it from an ethical point of view, have an obligation to follow up on those allegations earlier?
I think that institutions always have an obligation, especially because of the people to whom they are accountable, to follow up on you know, concerning allegations. However, I'm not a legal scholar, and I'm not really able to comment on the particularities of this. I do know that in general, these large institutions follow specific protocols and procedures to try to solve these problems, and they often take much longer than anyone desires. And my sense is that you know, the medical school is following the appropriate path. I know it will just take a while.
Mm. Well, the obligation, I mean, I know there are different obligations. There's obligations to their employees, of course, for privacy and due process and all that. But there are also obligations to the students, to the larger public.
Sure. Yeah, I think one of the things that's most effective in these circumstances is to just create platforms whereby the leadership can listen to the concerns of those, you know, part of the leadership's understanding what is going on will be by listening to those, you know, at the school. And that's students, faculty, employees, you know, at all levels.
What kind of damage does a scandal like this do to a venerable institution like USC, the medical school there?
In the short term, it always creates, you know, any scandal like this always is unnerving, creates a sense of dissatisfaction, restlessness. There's a lot of finger pointing, a lot of blame. But that can also be turned around by an appropriate institutional response and by an institution that's willing to be transparent in the process, as honest and forthright as it can be within the constraints of the legal system, and that is willing to listen and engage the concerns of its community. I think in situations like this, communication is really important. Transparency is really important, and that you know, it would be prudent for any institution in a similar circumstance to strive for that.
And I don't know if you can comment on this directly because you're not intimately involved, but from what you can see from the outside, do you think USC has done that, has been transparent enough?
I think they are trying to move in that direction, sure. But no, I cannot comment specifically.
All right. Well, I want to thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you.
That's Dr. Lydia Dugdale, medical professor and associate director of the Program for Biomedical Ethics at the Yale School of Medicine. Coming up on the program, a star student who loves to surf ends up attracted to radical Islam.
Teenage groups are always on the verge of accepting and always on the verge of rejecting. And it is a number of these rejections that could lead somebody to become interested in something as severe as radicalism.
A novel set in Laguna Beach based on research on real stories of teens who leave their comfortable homes to fight for ISIS. That's next on Press Play.
Introducing the KCRW donation car, designed to be recycled. This first-of-its-kind vehicle will save you time, space, and hassle by disappearing. Enjoy the luxury and comfort of turning your underused car into a donation worth hundreds, even thousands of dollars. The KCRW donation car, already in your garage, driveway, or on cinder blocks outside your house. Act now at kcrw.com/cars.
This is Press Play on KCRW. I'm Madeline Brand. Rez Cordy seems to be your typical Southern California surfer dude, pothead, high school senior. Born and raised in wealthy Laguna, he feels completely assimilated. But Rez is also a second-generation Iranian-American, and not everyone in his Orange County enclave thinks of him as one of their own. When jihadi terrorism hits a nearby mall, Rez finds that many neighbors and friends start looking at him differently, as the possible enemy. In response, though he's grown up in a secular household, Rez begins taking an interest in what it means to be Muslim. That's the setup for a new novel by author Laleh Khedivi. The book is called A Good Country, and Laleh Khedivi joins me now. Welcome.
Thank you.
So this is a book that tries to explain how a young man who has done extremely well, is American, born and raised in America, how he could become radicalized. Why did you want to try to answer that question?
I think it's one of the great questions of our time. Given the sort of rise of terrorism all over the world and terrorism by young people in the name of religion, I am fascinated by what would make a human soul go to such extremes. And the inspiration for this particular book came not from the United States, because we do not have sort of, as they phrase it, homegrown terrorism in the way that they have in Europe. And I spent a lot of time studying the stories of the youth in England, France, Germany, the Netherlands, who had lived as immigrants and either middle class or lower middle class, the children of men and women who had migrated there from the Middle East or North Africa, and then decided at some point that the cultures around them were never going to let them fully in. And that kind of fascinated me. And to see that they were going back to the Middle East in numbers to join organizations that were, you know, more or less death cults made me want to think about, okay, take an average teenager whose concerns are grades, college, being liked, meeting men or women, whatever it may be, and have that flipped 180 degrees to a complete opposite.
So I guess just teasing that out a little bit, you say that you couldn't really do this kind of research here in the United States because it doesn't exist in the way it does in Europe. So was it difficult for you then to say, okay, yeah, this could happen in a place like Laguna?
It was in some sense difficult. And in another sense, it was easy because I think teenagers are the same all over the world. Mm-hmm. They have, especially immigrant teenagers, they have this desire to fit in that is both of their age, but also, if you are an immigrant, of your circumstance. So the levels of fitting in are double. It's not only to try to be, you know, well-liked in your peer group, but it's also to try to be well-liked in your country. And now with Rez, I was curious about what happens when we leave nation altogether and enter into a post-national self, somebody who is more identified with a community on the internet than they might be with their friends and neighbors.
Well, first he tries to become a part of his high school community and the community of surfers. And he seems pretty successful at becoming part of that community.
He does. It's tenuous, and he tries very hard, and he is accepted. And there is an episode which their car is vandalized on a surf trip to Mexico, and the blame, because he is the outsider, falls to him. And being a sensitive teenager, he takes this very hard. And I wanted to show the ways in which teenage groups are always on the verge of accepting and always on the verge of rejecting. And it is a number of these rejections that could lead somebody to become interested in something as severe as radicalism.
Right. And so after that happens, his dad, who's really angry that he fell in with these boys, he says to Rez, "Those boys, the ones you think are your friends, will always think of you as an outsider, as an immigrant, the foreign kid. If you go with them, try to be as they are, I will not be able to help you in that life." So it's not just the outside world in this instance giving Rez the message he doesn't fit in. It's his own family, too.
Yes, this is the tightrope that I feel many immigrant kids have to walk. And I used myself as a template. My upbringing was not as glamorous as that, and I was a rather nerdy student. But I did have to figure out, as I became a citizen when I was 14, and as I sort of identified with being American, what part of my Iranianness would have to fall to the side. And there was no tension from my home regarding this, and there was no tension from my school life. It was something that I was navigating on my own as I sort of moved through the world.
And so what parts did you lose or drop?
I think temporarily, as a high school student, the desire to fit in was very great. And so maybe I did not speak Farsi when I could have. I think I began to identify with American music, American and European film, American literature, in a way that sort of pushed Iranian poetry or, you know, sort of following the trajectory of Persian cooking, these ways in which you cultivate yourself to know something about a culture. I had kind of like let go.
And did you re-embrace that, your Persian culture?
Yes and no. I think at some point you get too old to learn how to cook. And so I might have missed that boat completely. But in terms of...
It's never too old to learn how to cook.
The kitchen is a foreign space. Pretty soon after I left high school, after that intense incubation period, I went to college and then got a job and realized that there were ways in which to draw from the wealth of my inheritance and incorporate that into my life. And so now I speak Farsi with my children, who are very young. I am much more well-versed in Persian literature and poetry. I have access to those things, minus the cooking, as I mentioned, in a way that I did not before.
If you're just joining me, I'm speaking with the author Laleh Khadivi about her new novel. It's called A Good Country. The girlfriend of Rez, Fatima, she takes another tack. She decides to fully embrace her Muslim heritage. And so I was wondering if you ever considered that as a solution to your feelings of outsiderness.
No, I am sort of by habit not an extremely religious person. But Fatima was an interesting experiment as a writer because I was thinking about the condition of feminism in the West today and how by its standards it excludes Islam. And what that must feel like to a girl in high school who is both feminist and Muslim. Mm-hmm. And I wanted to understand how you could navigate those two terrains.
Well, she's a very sexual being, Fatima.
Yes, yes. And that is the other misconception, I think, that people have, is that Islam mutes the woman, when in actuality, there are various interpretations known all over the world, and not all of them mute the woman. And Fatima is just in the right place to have access to that and to also claim herself as a Muslim woman.
There is a moment in the novel when Rez is coming back into the country after having a surfing vacation in Bali, and he's taken aside by an immigration officer and questioned. And then there's this really harsh interaction where basically the immigration officer tells him, you can have the outward trappings of success. You can go to college, you can make a bunch of money, but deep down you'll know you're worthless. The children are worthless, and the American dream will never play out. And then you write in Rez's mind, he says, the man was not wrong, and his speech repeated inside Rez. Do you think the man was not wrong, or is that Rez thinking that erroneously?
Well, I think it's Rez thinking that. I had to show in the fiction, in order to fall prey to the propaganda of radical organizations, he was going to slowly have to make it a them versus him situation. And when this very harsh speech is given to him and he's locked in this room and he's been taken aside, trying to get back into the United States, having done absolutely nothing wrong, he had no choice. His character had no choice but to believe the man. He had seen it play out in his life. He had seen it play out for his father. He'd seen it play out in his school. And I feel like this is how people end up curious about radical anything, whether it be Islam or Christianity. And if he was a little older, if he was a little bit more secure in himself, if he was a little bit more amongst community that was reliable, I don't think he would be as susceptible. But as is the case with the European adolescents, they are generally all under 26.
And what's terrifying, the way you portray it, is how attractive these recruiters make going to Raqqa, going to Syria. They fill these kids' heads with dreams of paradise, of creating a beautiful society, of being able to do whatever you want, free of suspicion and discrimination, when around them the news is quite the opposite. And yet they want to believe so badly that they will believe a stranger they've met on the internet over the news and the people around them.
Yeah, that is the ultimate tragedy, is that the truth of the matter, the facts and the images and the violence are ignored because the heart is so hurt that the desire for a better life, even if it is completely unproven or unshown, is greater than what any evidence to the contrary might be. I think that men and women who pursued the Underground Railroad in a similar way felt that unknown hope. And he doesn't want to think that he is joining a violent organization. He doesn't want to think that this is going to end badly. He does all of this with hope. He does all of this for the idea, this dream, that there's a society in which these tensions will be removed from his life.
So is this the last book in your series?
It is. She says with relief.
Because I was hoping you would then write a book about Fatima and her experiences.
You are not the first person to say that. And I have been thinking about it insofar as she is a fascinating character. And I think that what happens to her at the end of the book is worth following. I am tired after three books, and also maybe not ready to reapproach a very heavy political personal story. And I think I want to take a small break and maybe write about music or fashion or something else.
Something less heavy. I will say, yes, though, you do capture the teenager. It seems like you are definitely a fly on the wall at their parties, when Rez is out surfing. How did you do that?
It's kind of this weird sort of removal of myself and my experiences, and this allowing the other to enter in, to really channel a character who is a accumulation of many, many people. Who is? I taught in high schools. I taught in juvenile jails. I taught in middle schools. I have been around these age groups a lot, and the atmosphere of just simply the hormonal mist that you exist in when you teach in a high school is so pervasive that I feel like I ended up breathing a lot of it in. But I also, I mean, I was a teenager. I was not Rez by any means. I was far dorkier. But I was around those kids who were, you know, striving to be more popular or striving to be accepted. And I watched and I saw the ways in which it did and did not work for them. And I think I just kind of was able to lock into that.
Do you surf?
I did. For about six summers. I had one particularly successful summer on a longboard, and I have been trying to get back ever since, but the Northern California waters that surround me are freezing. And the Eden that is Southern California is hard to get to. So I'm working on it.
Well, it's been a pleasure speaking with you. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Lale Khedive, she's the author of the new novel, A Good Country.
Introducing the KCRW donation car, designed to be recycled. This first-of-its-kind vehicle will save you time, space, and hassle by disappearing. Enjoy the luxury and comfort of turning your underused car into a donation worth hundreds, even thousands of dollars. The KCRW donation car, already in your garage, driveway, or on cinder blocks outside your house. Act now at kcrw.com/cars.
This is Press Play on KCRW. I'm Madeline Brand. Frank Ocean at FYF Saturday night, and while he was singing on the giant screen, a close-up of Brad Pitt standing at the lip of the stage, looking soulful, with a cell phone to his ear. Missy Elliott did her first full live show there in almost a decade. Bjork, Nine Inch Nails, A Tribe Called Quest, Iggy Pop, and our own KCRW DJ Mario Cotto. Quite the lineup. Hi, Mario.
Hi.
Thanks for coming in. I know you're probably fried.
I am double fried. I'm crispy, but okay. I'm super stoked. It was an amazing weekend.
Full disclosure, you are paid by FYF to perform, right? To DJ
yes.
on the main stage.
Yes.
Right. So you saw it close up, the machinery. What was that like being on stage looking out?
It was really something. I basically was doing transitional sets between the acts. So I was playing music before Bjork came on. So I was there like when gates opened and people start flooding in, and I'm playing, you know, very atmospheric house and stuff, like vibey stuff, and people just, they really just want to get it started and see Bjork. And then—
Wait, you didn't feel the audience was with you?
And not at first, you know, but they, you know, people start getting into it and maybe get a cocktail, maybe get a slice of pizza, you know, and then, you know, by the time the sun set and things started, it was really, really lovely.
And that night also Missy Elliott played.
Missy Elliott.
So let me play a clip from that. She's doing her first live show in 10 years.
Higher, higher, Missy be putting it down. I'm the hottest round. I told your mother, woo-hoo. Y'all can't stop me now. Hey. Listen to me now. Hey. I'm lasting 20 rounds. And if you want me, bigger. Then come on, get me now. Hey. Is you with me now? Hey. Biggie, biggie, bounce. I know you did the way I switch my style. Oh. People say,
Was it really fun?
It was super fun. They rolled her out in this huge, like Metropolis, Fritz Lang kind of like LED coffin, and they opened it up, and she was just all in silver. And then there were kids like on roller skates on the stage, and like maybe 12 backup dancers breakdancing. It was phenomenal. But I saw that kid on skates. I was like, that's insane. Because they're so high up, and these like kids are just rolling
just
around.
Skate on off the stage. So how do you compare this festival, this three-day event, mm-hmm. with Coachella? It's also produced by Golden Voice.
Yes. You know, Coachella is more soft focus. It's so broad, like, and massive. And it feels like stages go on forever and ever, and you can get all different styles of music. FYF, also you get lots of different styles of music, but it feels very personal. It's got a fingerprint on it. And you feel every act has been put there for a purpose.
And what about the vibe of the place itself? Because it is in a parking lot. Mm-hmm. It's not, doesn't have the greatest vistas like Coachella. You have those beautiful mountains. You know, it's hot and dusty and there's not a lot of places to hang out.
Yeah, there was actually a moment during Nine Inch Nails where the fog machines were going and there were like some palm trees off in the distance. And I think they do a really good job of creating an environment that takes you somewhere else, even though, you know, off in the distance, they're building a massive stadium, you know, mm-hmm. the football club. And so, like, there's this mega industrial city thing going on, but you kind of lose yourself in the festival.
Speaking of Nine Inch Nails, here is a clip from them. They were the final act, the headliners last night. I've broken off my insides. I've got no soul to sell. The only thing that works for me. Help me get away from myself. And so Trent Reznor, Nine Inch Nails, they first came on the scene back in Lollapalooza back in 91, right?
And this is the, I want to say the eighth time I've seen them. I saw them in 95. I saw them open with David Bowie. And previously, lots of the earlier shows that I'd gone to, it was like super aggro, like people just wiling out. It felt like maybe you were in hell. I don't know. But this was actually one of the best shows they've ever done that I've seen.
Highlights for you?
Highlights. Right before Tribe Called Quest came on, I'm playing all this like golden age hip hop and some soul and stuff, and the production assistant runs up and is like, Tip wants to hear some Marvin Gaye right now. Like, come on, can you put some Marvin Gaye on to get him? So I put on some Marvin Gaye, and all of a sudden they just like, A Tribe Called Quest emerges, and I was like, that's insane, man.
Which song did you play?
I played T Plays It Cool off of Trouble Man.
KCRW DJ Mario Cotto, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Okay, Trouble Man in the studio, Christian Bardal. Hi.
Hey there. How's it going, Madeline?
It's going great. Yourself?
It's going okay.
Did you go to any of these concerts?
I didn't go to any of these concerts, and I feel bereft, like hearing about how many
really
great artists there were. Oh, my goodness.
I blew it, too. I didn't go to that. I mean, I didn't blow it because I got to go to the Sound and Focus
to see
concert.
Missy Elliott live again for the first time in ages. Oh, my goodness. That would have been great.
I know. So I went to KCRW Sound and Focus and saw Paul Oakenfold.
Oh, nice.
And that was fun. Yeah.
I bet.
That legendary DJ.
Huh.
That was super fun.
Yeah. And Frank Ocean. I would love to have seen Frank Ocean as well.
Also, not at the Sound and Focus, but at FYF. Yes.
Why was Brad Pitt hanging out there with a cell phone? These are questions we all need answered. But quickly, just earlier, you were talking about Democrats making the most of their moment and coming out with a big new plan called a better deal, better skills, better jobs, better wages. The Twitter reaction hasn't been that great.
Been better.
Conservative Mama says the Democrat Party is run by global elitists promising free handouts while taxing the hell out of the middle class. Hashtag better deal. Goes on from there. I did also run a little poll asking people if President Trump will, in fact, pardon himself. And 63% said probably. 17% said no way. 20% too early to tell. So there you go.
Yeah, there you go. Well, that was the talk of the weekend.
It was,
seems to have died down today, at least for a moment. All right, so thank you very much, Christian Bardal. And if you'd like to weigh in on anything that you hear on our program, we would love to hear it. Twitter at KCRW Press Play. The same thing with Facebook, KCRW Press Play. I'm Madeline Brand, and I will see you tomorrow.